From the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, this is Voices of Public Intellectuals. I'm your host, Florence Ladd. This week's program features Lonnie Guinier, Harvard Law professor and founder of Commonplace, a nonprofit organization engaging citizens in civic dialogue across language barriers and adversarial cultural differences. The title of her talk today is Rethinking Gender, Race, and Power. Here to introduce Professor Guinier is Acting Dean of the Radcliffe Institute, Mary Maples Dunn.
Well, good evening. On behalf of the Radcliffe Seminars and the Graduate Consortium on Women's Studies, it's a pleasure to welcome you to tonight's lecture and to welcome Lonnie Guinier, an extraordinary woman, lawyer, gentleman, and writer. Those of you who laugh know that one of Lonnie's books is Becoming Gentleman. Lonnie Guinier, the first black woman tenured professor at the Harvard Law School, is author of a new book, Lift Every Voice, Turning Civil Rights Setback into a New Vision of Social Justice. And this is, I think, one of her most important works. Guinier came to public attention in 1993 when President Clinton nominated her to be the first black woman to head the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, and then withdrew her nomination without a confirmation hearing, or indeed any apology. The experience prompted her to write this new book, which uses the nomination debacle as a window on the civil rights movement's past, present, and future. It's nice to be able to tell you that Professor Guinier is a graduate of Radcliffe College and of Yale University Law School, and she's been recognized for her achievements with many awards, including the 1995 Champion of Democracy Award from the ABA Commission on Women in the Profession, and what I'm sure especially pleases her, the 1994 Rosa Parks Award from the American Association of Affirmative Action. Professor Guinier, whose views on democracy and voting rights and her book, The Tyranny of the Majority, were widely misinterpreted and vilified during her nomination as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. And she was denied an opportunity to speak for herself at the time. Her experience led her to create Commonplace, a new organization intended to transform public discourse and democratic decision-making. This national nonprofit center connects citizens, communities, and ideas. At Commonplace, people can come together to learn how to communicate across language barriers created by academic jargon, by soundbite journalism, by adversarial culture, and racial, gender, and social differences. The goal is to talk through difference about race, gender, and other important social issues, and to use conversation to develop innovative and collaborative approaches to collective decision making. And so I present to you Lonnie Guinier for tonight's conversation on rethinking gender, race, and power. Professor Guinier.
Thank you very much. I would like to use this lecture to raise a set of questions around which much of my work, both as a civil rights lawyer and as an academic, have much of my work has revolved. My work has really been about the dynamics of winning and losing, and I have explored the ways in which we design rules to determine who wins and who loses, and most importantly, why do the losers keep playing the game? One of my most profound insights about this, and I call it profound because it came from my four-year-old son, Nicholas, occurred as we were reading a Sesame Street magazine article. Now, it is not easy to read a Sesame Street magazine article. You look at a Sesame Street magazine article. It was a picture of six kids trying to decide what game to play, and four had their hands raised because they wanted to play tag, and two had their hands down because they wanted to play hide and seek. And the magazine asked the reader to count the number of kids whose hands were raised and then to decide what game they should play. And my son, at the time was four, dutifully counted up the number of kids who wanted to play tag. There were four, number who wanted to play hide and seek, two. So what game would they play? They would play both. First they would play tag, then they would play hide and seek. And his explanation was that those who wanted to play tag were in the majority and the majority should go first. But those who wanted to play hide and seek should also get to take a turn. So that's been the way in which I articulated much of my work interpreting and trying to push hard on the idea of voting, that it was not enough just to vote. You also had to be in a position to influence the way the votes were counted. And I want to talk today about another aspect of that same question. And these are all fundamental questions about democracy. And that is, do we think about democracy in the context of power? And when we think about democracy in the context of power, do we think about power in zero-sum terms? That was certainly the assumption in the Sesame Street magazine article, that those who win, those with the four hands up, get to decide what game everyone should play. So I win, you lose. Power is the power to control. Power is the power to dominate. Power is power over. And what I would like to explore tonight is the complementary concept of power with. This is a concept that many feminists have explored before me. It is a notion of power that is generative, creative, coactive, and not necessarily coercive. And part of the question is, how can those two concepts, the concept of power over, the power to dominate, to coerce, to control, and power with, the idea of collaborating, of being creative and generative in joyful interaction with others, how can those two concepts coexist? Or does one tend to substitute for or indeed dominate the other? So let me start by telling you a story. This is a story again about my son Nicholas. We were moving to Cambridge. This was a year and a half ago. And we were leaving Philadelphia, where Nicholas had spent all of his life up till then. And a group of longtime Philadelphia friends decided to give a going away party to remind Nico that while he was leaving Philadelphia, he was not in fact leaving his friends. The children organized a relay race, the boys versus the girls. The object of the game was to carry a golf ball on a spoon without dropping the ball or letting your hands touch the ball. Both times, the girls' team won. The girls won, it seemed, because they kept their eyes on the ball, slow and steady. The boys kept their focus on the outcome and assumed raw speed would get them first to the finish line, which, after all, was the object in their mind. As the boys became aware that they were losing, because speed alone does not keep a golf ball on a spoon, they experimented with different and devious strategies to advance swiftly to the finish line. They threw the golf ball forward toward the finish line. Technically, this did not violate the no-touch rule because they did not touch the ball with their hands. They palmed the cup of the spoon in their hand rather than holding the stem of the spoon as they had been instructed. But none of their efforts to bend the rules enabled their team to finish first. While this game is going on, there are a group of adults, many of us academics, sitting around, and of course, we began to deconstruct the game. We analyzed the game as symbolic. It was symbolizing contemporary gender dynamics, differences attributed to either cultural or natural tendencies of boys and girls at play. Girls are better at fine motor skills. Boys have gross motor skills. Girls are more people-oriented. Girls are more oriented to preserving their relationships. Girls don't cheat, but follow the rules or cooperate with authority rather than challenge or resist it. Indeed, because girls are traditionally considered powerless, or at least less powerful in a culture in which power is at least conventionally considered both zero-sum and controlling, girls find alternative ways of establishing connections with each other to substitute a network of relationships for their otherwise individual weakness. Thus, girls care more about making friends, not winning games or dominating opponents. But as with all first impressions, there was a lot more beneath the surface. My mother was present, and she interjected an important observation. Who designed the game? The girls. They were the official hosts of the party. The girls designed the game, apparently, to play to their strengths, and the boys assumed that the game, like most games involving physical activity, was designed to play to their strengths. Now, before returning to this idea that the game conformed to all manner of gender stereotypes, let me add that when the girls were asked to pose for a picture as the winners, they assumed, "I'm so tough, see my muscles," stance. Right? Arguably, the girls became boys. And then, as the winners, the girls went on to play other games that did not either appeal to or even include the boys. My son got upset. Right? He thought that he was the guest of honor at this party. At the time, he was 11, and I asked him why did he care that the girls were excluding him. There were plenty of boys to play with, and he said, because the girls are in the majority. And there were, in fact, more girls than boys. Now, what I would like to try and tease out of this game are the three dimensions of zero-sum power. Power over, power to dominate, to control, to coerce, is not just the power that you see in the visible competition of the relay race. But my mom's question, in some ways a more significant intervention, suggests that we have to look at the rules of the game. Who sets the agenda? Because oftentimes the way we construct the agenda, the way we structure the rules, determines the outcome. So if the first dimension is the visible contest, the second dimension is the rules, the agenda, the structure of play. And then the third dimension of zero-sum power over is the story that the winners tell the losers that somehow convince both that they deserve their lot in life. Right, the story that the winners tell the losers to convince the winners and the losers that they each deserve their lot in life. And so in the case of the game, those who win somehow convey the impression, or at least at this going away party, that they were then entitled to determine all of the other games that they were going to play, especially since they could invoke their power as the majority. Now, these three dimensions of power are all subsets of power over. And what I would like to introduce is the challenge of identifying ways in which we can hold on to and continue to embrace the idea of power with, so that in order to play in the game of democracy, we can begin to construct spaces for experimentation, for play, for interaction, in which the premise is not simply that the girls have to become boys in order to win, but in which the understanding is that we are playing a different game, and that this is a game of collaboration, a game in which the goal is not simply to dominate, to coerce, to control, a game in which we may be agnostic about the specific outcome, but a game in which the joy and the energy of playing the game may yield innovative and unpredictable, indeed surprising, results that prove even more powerful than anything we might have initially anticipated. Now, is this just a fantasy that I have concocted so that I could give a lecture about race, gender, and power? Maybe. And indeed, one of my colleagues who was visiting at Harvard Law School said, you know, Lonnie, you are a devotee of a school of Latin American literary critics called magical realists. So I am sure there's an element of magic in this discussion. But on the other hand, I would prefer to call that element of magic faith. And it is an element of faith in the power of people working together to come up with solutions that are new, that are innovative, and that generate more enthusiasm for continuing to play the game. So that what I am interested in is not just deciding who's right and who's wrong, who's winning and who's losing, but how do we continue to mobilize energy and enthusiasm about playing the game? And I want to talk to you briefly about one game that I'm particularly familiar with, the game of law school. And I want to talk about this using the experience of women, because for me, in trying to understand issues of power and issues of democracy, I have found that women, like people of color, are often what I call the miner's canary. The miners used to take a canary into the mines to alert them when the atmosphere in the mines was too toxic for the miners to stay. And the canary's more fragile respiratory system would give way first, signaling that there was a problem with the atmosphere in the mines. My claim is that the experience of women, the experience of people of color, the experience of those who've been left out, the experience of the losers is often the experience of the canary. And unfortunately, the way in which we tend to think about that experience in conventional power over, power as control, power as domination, power that valorizes only winning, is to locate the problem of losing in the canary. So we pathologize the canary. And we say that the solution is therefore to outfit the canary with a little pint-sized gas mask so that it can withstand the toxic atmosphere in the mines. The claim I am making tonight is that we need to heed the signal of the canary, because we need to rethink the way in which the minds are dominated by a power over mentality, the way in which the winners tend to come up with the meta narrative that continues to dominate the consciousness, not only of the winners, but the losers, and often suggest to both the winners and the losers they deserve their lot in life, and thus pacifies or paralyzes the losers from challenging the rules of the game. So part of the claim is to see if we can liberate the canary from this meta-narrative to begin to tell a different story, the story of power with. So how do we get from the canary to law school? Well, I was a professor for 8 years at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and one of my students wanted to do a video. She had seen a video of medical school in which all of the professors were women, in which all of the discussion was about what happens to women when they get various illnesses. And one young male in the class tentatively raises his hand and asks the female important professor, "What happens if a man gets this disease?" And the woman professor wheels around and turns to him and looks at him dismissively and says, "Well, you're smart. Extrapolate. Figure it out." So this was Anne's revenge, right? She wanted to do the same thing for law school. She wanted to show the girls becoming boys. She wanted to show how if you put women in a position of power over, they can do to the men exactly what has been done to them. At least that was her original picture. At the time, I was perfectly willing to supervise her project, although I knew nothing about video. It occurred to me she should write a script. And she came back with a set of stories about her own experience. And I said, "Anne, if you are going to invest all of this time and energy into making a video, don't you want some assurance that your experiences, if not typical, are at least representative?" So she did a survey. And she put a copy of the survey in the mail folders of all of the students then enrolled, and over 50% of the students responded. And the responses were very disheartening. One of the things that she discovered is that many of the women, this was not a longitudinal study, but just in this snapshot, many of the first-year women came to the law school wanting to do public interest or public service work. About a third of the women first year wanted to do public interest or public service. About 10% of the men wanted to do public interest or public service first year. Among the third year women, about 8% of the women wanted to do public interest, public service, and about 5% of the men wanted to do public interest or public service. The women were also not participating in class. Two-thirds of the women never raised their hand in class, never raised their hand to ask a question or to answer a question. Two-thirds of the men who responded to the survey consistently raised their hand in class. The big difference that Anne found between the first-year students and the third-year women, it bothered the first-year women that they did not speak in class. It no longer bothered the third-year women that they did not speak in class, although their rate of participation was essentially unchanged. We then took these results, and I went to the dean, and I asked him if we could look at the academic performance of the men and women to see if the way in which the men and women were interpreting or experiencing the law school had any effect on their grades. We had seen, for example, that the men and women looked for different qualities in a professor. The men and women both looked for a professor who had knowledge of the subject matter and who expressed ideas clearly, but the women wanted a professor who also treated students with respect. That was not as essential a quality for the men. So the dean gave us all of the data because at the time he was a new dean, and he assumed that anything we found would reflect, if at all, on his predecessor. Well, what we found was even more disheartening than the self-reported survey results. The women came to the law school with virtually the same academic credentials, same LSAT, same undergraduate GPA. I said virtually the same, meaning their LSAT was a little bit lower, not statistically significant. Their undergraduate GPA was a little bit higher, not statistically significant. And yet within the first year, the men had three times as great a chance of being in the top 10% as the women, and 1.5 times as great a chance of being in the top 50% as the women. And that differential was sustained over the 3 years in law school. So I take these findings to my colleagues. I am very concerned. What are we going to do about this? Well, some of them thought, this showed we're admitting the wrong women, right? Pathologize the canary. Locate the problem in the canary. If you can't locate the problem in the canary, then move to identify the problem outside of the institution that you are now studying. So several of my colleagues said, have you looked at the differential in the LSAT of the men and the women, even though it was statistically insignificant? We did that, and we found, lo and behold, the LSAT is a very poor predictor of first-year grades for men and for women, right? It predicts about 14% of the variance in first-year grades. It does a little better second year, 15%. Nationwide, we found out that the LSAT explains about 9% of the difference in first-year grades, 9% better than random. So then they wanted to look at, well, maybe this undergraduate record doesn't really tell us very much, since the women's undergraduate record was stronger than the men. Were the women majoring in soft subjects? No? So finally, one of my colleagues came up with an hypothesis: varsity sports. His theory was, in college, the men get engaged, involved in varsity sports, and their grades suffer as a result. But then they get to law school, where there are no varsity sports, and their true academic potential is realized. Now, I lay all of this out to you because I don't think he was that far off the mark in this manner. Much of what has been written about the Socratic classroom caricatures it. There is definitely learning that goes on when a sage on the stage professor cold calls on a student and then tries to make an example of that student's ignorance in front of the rest of the class. Power over, right? The professor has power over the student and is using that power to try to, if not coerce, at least manipulate the students into learning. Some people call this learning how to ask rude questions, right? Most of the time when people want to know something, they ask a question. They want to know the answer. Lawyers are trained never to ask a question to which you don't already know the answer. And therefore, when you ask a question, when you call on a student and ask a question, the goal is not to find the answer to the question, but to demonstrate what the student does not know and what you, as a professor who has edited the case book and read all of the cases before and after the case at hand, do know. Now, the men apparently see this as a game. And in a game, as with the relay race, right, the goal is to be first. You win by being first. Speed is valued. So they raise their hand. They get called on. They set the agenda. They haven't yet figured out what it is they want to say, so they have to speak at some length. They learn how to hold the attention of an audience. The women, right? They don't see this as a game. They see it as a learning community. They want to build on what somebody else has said before they speak. They want to say something that is relevant. They write down their comments. They edit what they have just written down. They revise what they have edited until they are confident that what they have to say really moves the discussion forward, represents a contribution. By then, the class has moved on to another subject. Or they have summarized, they have synthesized the comments in such a brilliant fashion that, unlike the male student who is learning leadership skills as he speaks at great length, thinking aloud, inviting people in to follow his thinking process, they speak and no one understands what they just said. I had a student who delivered a haiku poem. It was a brilliant synthesis of everything we had discussed in class, but only she and I understood what it was she was saying.
You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Lonnie Guinier.